Okay, let's have a little look at where we are and what we've just done. It's a bit surprising, actually. It's interesting. I mean, I normally have an idea about what we're going to do, and I knew there was going to be something about the co-worker this morning. But I was set up to do the usual three chants that we do, and that sort of thing. It's interesting how these things work. Once you sort of hold an intention and you start to pay attention to these deeper places. Well, one of the things that happens is that things have their own life. So one of the things that has started to happen to me was that the vowel chant went on longer than usual. And then it was just like these trees came into the room. And instead of going down or going in, it was clear that we were just meant to be here and to bring the two worlds together. So there's an old birch tree, and then the burning ash appears, and then the sort of oak in the sea, and then this huge yew appears, and then the mountains, boom, just there, in quite a different shape. And it's interesting, this sort of, obviously you know kind of what happened to me, because I'm telling it to you, because what I'm doing when I do these things is I'm paying attention to myself, but also paying attention to the group, and then describing what happens as a sort of ground for whatever happens to you. And then, of course, this is my own journey anyway. We're left all sitting there, you then in the deep places of the mound. And it's always a bit of a lesson to me that you have to kind of try and trust what happens to you. Because what happened to me, I didn't much like at first. And then I thought, oh, well. And the reason I didn't like it's interesting is because when things appear cliched to me, then I don't really like it. So when people are having feathers and leaves, I think, well, that's really, or boots, I think that's really interesting. That's kind of an unusual image. I don't know why. But what actually happened to me was I have this sense of a mass of beings and all kinds of beings and sort of, and what happened to me is that the figure called Lilith LeFay, which I've just commissioned a picture of, my friend of mine, Stuart Little John, is in the framers at the moment being framed up. This figure suddenly pushed through everything else and announced that she was my co-walker. And I didn't really like the idea of it because I thought, oh, bloody hell, that's a picture, and it looks like Stuart's picture. So, okay, and it came from my picture. I designed it, he drew it, he painted it for me. But it was a bit too sort of familiar, and I thought, oh, I don't really think I want that. But actually, it was really, no. And so she sort of insisted, I am going to be your co-walker, and I have to come back with you, and she's quite a big figure, and kind of, and...
Show people the picture.
Oh, I could actually, couldn't I? I'll find the phone. Oh, I'll pass it round. Show you the co-walker. That's all right, that's sealed. That's why I have one of those, because I knock cups over all the time. That's brilliant. It's sealed. It doesn't... it's all right. Nothing happens. Nothing comes out. That's why I have it. There's a sort of... It's designed to be me-proof, exactly, because over the years, I've just cut...
Tommy Tippy for grown-ups.
Yeah, thanks for that. Thank you so much for that. I really. And if you just. That's. It's done something weird. Hang on, so just get it to go away. Yeah, there we go. Just pass it around. That's been a more living version of that picture, obviously, but it is that.
No, she won't take no for an answer.
She really didn't take no for an answer. It's very, very strong. Well, that's what happened to me, right? So that's exactly, and you're a bit fascinated by that image at the moment, you're bound to, so I had basically to kind of sit with it, and sort of, because normally when I do that, obviously, common images or things I've been, come, but if you sit with them, and just, they can normally lose life. What happened is it actually just gained energy and density and kept, in a way, kept sort of insisting that, and started to change shape as well. So there was a real sense of physicality about it.
Yeah.
And so there's something about what happens with the sort of, if you like, more surface images, they're normally quite repetitive as well. Right, so they don't kind of take you anywhere. So always the key thing with these images is that you hang out with them. It's basically the rule of thumb for any of this is you hang out with it and see where it takes you. If it takes you into a repetitive, stereotypic dead end, okay, then you drop the image and come back to your felt sense of wherever you are. Because what happens is as you have been discovering, these images, however they present themselves, kind of accompany you and take you kind of places. And there's often one of the things that's often there. They're often a bit surprising, and a bit slightly disturbing, or kind of, and you know. So in a way, the thing with the Lilith image that came to me was that I wasn't thrilled. You know, if I'd been, oh great, Lilith has come, that's more of a sign of me just getting into my own thing and wanting it to be there. It's a bit like, well, hang on a minute, I'd rather something else. Thanks very much.
Is she going in here? Is she going to be?
No.
No, she won't. She's going to come to.
I've got. Watching me.
No, she's coming. She's going to go home to my meditation. She's going to be in my meditation room at home. So she's quite a personal kind of image in some ways. But it was a really interesting sort of process in that I didn't like it. I tried to go away from it as well, and then it insisted. So that's kind of what happens with these quite alive kind of images. They have their own life, and in a way, that's what Robert Kirk is trying to say to us. These are living beings with their own life. They're not just images in your own head that you can kind of manipulate. What's been interesting about the various things that have happened to people as well is, again, it is like the way he describes it. You encounter these beings, they're changeable, they shift around, they're kind of, and they do behave like independent beings. They're not a little bit of my psyche doing something.
That's why I didn't talk about it.
Yeah, so what happened to you?
It's all in my head.
Yeah, go on. So tell me about it. Tell me on.
Well, I had this buttercup fairy, which I've actually got on my windowsill in my cottage. So I kept trying to push it away and go, no, you're just the little fairy, I've got the windowsill.
Yeah.
You can't be the one. You can't be in this vision thing.
Yeah, go on.
And I kept seeing all these other creatures like you guys, and I saw this deer. I was like, I like you, you can be mine.
Yeah.
Come on, deer. And this deer just looked at me.
No, it wouldn't go. Okay.
He's a little buttercup, but he kept coming back.
Yeah.
And then when you said, where is it with you now?
Yeah.
It just kept saying, well, I'm at the cottage, you idiot.
Okay.
It wasn't with me.
No, but she's still in your field. So if you pay attention, so if you just pay attention to her now, just pay attention to the buttercup fairy. Just see what happens. So what's happening?
It's quite funny. She's flying around the room with all the other fairies I've got on the windowsill.
Mm-hmm. What happens to you when you come into contact with her? What happens?
She keeps showing me this eye as well.
Yeah.
Open your eyes. This is like this great big eye.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe it's about believing. Maybe.
Okay, good.
But really believing rather than
good.
So having the idea of it.
Great. So if you really believed, Maria, what would happen, do you think?
Well, she says that I would see all the real world as it is and not the world I'm living in.
Okay. So listen to that for a moment and see what that means to you.
Sad?
Yeah. Do you feel a bit sad? It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. It's okay. No, don't be sorry.
Stupid.
No, don't be stupid. It's not stupid. It's making you sound.
This feeling.
Hmm?
This feeling was this. It took me back to being a child and how it felt to be really connected, you know, with nature.
Yeah.
And see all the things that I used to see.
Okay, great.
But I feel really stupid, so I'm going to shut up now.
Try not to feel stupid. What's stupid here, Maria? What's feeling? What's the feeling of stupid?
I want to cry.
What's wrong with crying? You're just feeling a bit sad.
Because I know there is another world. The mm-hmm. world that I pushed away.
Okay.
So yeah.
Great.
So, I know.
Yeah.
What she's saying is that I could still access that world on my.
Okay.
I need to open my eyes.
Okay.
Yeah, she keeps saying, and it's like your third eye rather than a.
Yeah, so it's the deeper side, right?
Yeah.
So, but I guess what she's also pointing out, and what is probably real, is that you probably pushed it away because you needed to, because of whatever else was going on with you in your life. And
yeah.
That's probably where some of the sad feeling comes from. Okay. And the good bit here is it's not gone away, and you can still access it.
Yeah.
And that you're not being stupid is probably quite important.
Yeah, it's weird. We were talking about last night about how, what was it this morning when we were talking about how you have to hide your true self?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you try and tell people about what's going on around you,
yeah.
They all think you're mad, and mm-hmm. they all. Take the mickey.
Right.
You have to push it all away.
So that sounds really horrible, okay?
Yeah, you have to be in the world of what everyone else is in, this miserable world.
Yeah.
When you don't want to be, you want to be back in your own little fairy world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if the fairy world was the real world.
It felt more real to me than this world.
Yeah, so if it is the real world and part of and alongside everything else. It's just there, like the fairy is, alongside you. What difference would that make to your life?
It would be, I would have a much more sense of belonging than I do in this world.
Okay. So it might be something important about letting yourself look with that other eye. When you're at work, when you're doing ordinary things, and seeing where the fairy world is then. Because it's just alongside.
This felt so out of reach for a long time.
Yeah.
That's what she made, sorry, that's what I just felt all this emotion because she took me back to how it felt.
Good. So
and that's
right,
kind of
so that's
choking.
So that's great though, but that's good choking, but it's great because it means it's here now. It means you can feel it now.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
In a way, what Maria has just been showing us in a really important, very direct way, I think, is something that has happened to all of us in our different ways. In that, both that place of connection with something and the sense of loss of something. And the whole point really about this stuff of Robert Kirk and the co-walker, 17th century phrase, co-walker.
Did that word exist then?
In the 17th century, yes. It's a 17th, co-worker is a 17th century term. Okay. Co-worker is not.
No. Or co-counseling.
These are totally new for, but this is an actual co-worker, is actually what Robert Kirk writes in his book in the 17th century. So this is, it's not a modern, it's a very old term. It's an and it is that place of a companion who helps you to connect. Now, what he says in the Secret Commonwealth is that this companion, who is this living being, who will sometimes make fun of you, who will sometimes be challenging to you, who can be big or small, who can take all kinds of different shapes, but will help you to work with this idea of the second sight or second senses, other senses that have direct access to the what we might call the imaginal or the fairy world or the deep world or Anuvan. And the one of our problems is that we are not skilled at doing that because we live in a culture that these days focuses on surface and not depth. The tools of moving into depth and working with the complications of connecting to that place and then connecting to the surface. I mean, this is the thing that you find Jung talks in the beginning of the Red Book about. There are these two spirits. There is the spirit of our time, and there is the spirit of the depths. And how can the spirit of the depths and the spirit of our time come together and make beautiful music together? He didn't say that's my phrase. Right. So it's how do you marry up those two experiences? Now, one of the problems I think that people normally have is that as children, very often we are really in touch with the deep places. But of course, as our life moves forward, we're learning about how to relate to the surface, how to fit into society, how to fit into the world around us, if we were brought up in a shamanic society, if you'd had significant dreams or visions and you tell somebody about it, it's taken seriously. So people would get interested and talk to you about it. And that way you'd learn naturally about, well, how do you work with the world of fairies, and how do you bring that into relationship with the world of, now let's get on and do our job, sort of thing. Now, in a world that experienced that as meaningful, there would be structures and things that would help us. But if you go back to pre-Socratic Greece, and you go to court, and you go in to see somebody like Parmenides or Epimenides, who are judges of their cities, and you both lay people in trouble, they lay their case before them. One of the things the judge would do is to go into the oracle chamber of Apollo and sleep on it, and would go and listen to what the god Apollo has to say about the case, and that would have some bearing on the judgment that is made. And that literally used to happen. Now, in a way, we kind of dismiss all that because old superstitious people. But actually, these are the same people that invented logic, invented philosophy. These were not stupid people. They were not technologically, their technology was fairly primitive. But these are people. These are the ancient Greece is the and the, some of the other ancient civilizations are actually the people when you learn about the people. The people are not that different from us. They're kind of their human nature hasn't changed that much over those millennia.
Yeah, I guess we still say we need to sleep on it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So that's still around in some ways. So it's still around in an attenuated sort of form. That you listen to something that comes out of the depths. But what we don't have are structures. And so if you go to court these days, and sort of if the High Court judge announced, I'm just going off to the Oracle Cave and to see what God thinks about it. We would be worried. They often do fall asleep. It's true.
That's in court.
That's right. So in a way, of course, that's one of the path that we've all taken in our own different ways is in a society that says, in all kinds of different ways, this sort of inner experience is wrong. is dangerous, is can take you in a wrong path, fantasy can go mad, you know, so there's a whole load of prohibitions along the way. And it's why people like Jung are sort of useful in some ways, because here is somebody who was, you know, the Red Book over there was kept secret for 40 years, because even by Jung's family and by his own disciples, because they didn't feel respectable enough. Because what Jung does is he has all these visions and things, but then he writes up these immensely complicated books, interesting books, but very complicated and very kind of very much in tune with the academic culture of the time, because he's trying to protect that inner core of vision. And but what he literally, if you went to see Jung as a client, he had his version of that, which is a literal, you know, his hand created manuscript. And he used to use it as an oracular way with his patients. He'd get them to open the book sometime and read a bit out or look at pictures in the book, and then sort of riff off that a bit. And for Jung, his co-worker was a figure called Philemon, who is a philosopher who had the wings of a kingfisher. And Philemon, he would talk to Philemon, and Philemon would talk back to him and teach. And basically, one of the things he says is that all my work, all I learned was from my conversations with Philemon. He showed me. He showed me the. And one of the things he says is, in a very in different language, but very similar thing to Robert Kirk, is that he showed me the independent life of the soul. And now Kirk would say it in the world of fairy. He's using a slightly different paradigm. But Jung is saying exactly the same thing, that deeper part of the soul that is not just individual but also is collective, has its own independent life. We are not in control of that life. And actually what we have to do is cooperate with that independent life. And that literally means listening to the butterfly fairy and treating what she says seriously, and it goes for any of the other co-workers. The key thing, it's a significant thing to come into contact with these beings, and actually to treat it. What's required of us if we want to follow this is just to treat what's happened to us seriously. Mostly what people do these days is that they touch it and disconnect from it. And so it vanishes down in the depths and has to be refound. Now, and I understand why people do that, because actually, when you bring these two worlds together, the you come into contact with the childhood wound, the wound where you feel silly. That's why you kept apologizing just then and saying you're stupid. Right? You're touching that place in the past where that was said to you and where you believed it. It's really difficult for us all. We've all got our own versions of that, right? So you hit a place where somewhere, if you like, the solid-seeming world, and so now I'm asking you to talk about it. We're bringing it out from the inside into relationship. So we're, in a sense, what we're doing is constellating what happened to us when we were children. When we said to somebody, I've seen this, or this has happened to me. And of course, you know, the thing that's most, one of the things that's really awful for a child is to feel ashamed and humiliated. And very often these things are said, what comes back at a child when they say that, it's quite brutally dismissed, but often it's just laughed at. And aren't they being funny, aren't they amusing, aren't they cute? And often for the child that's devastating. Because they're not being cute, they're talking about something real. And I can viscerally remember those moments of shame myself, where you kind of feel so exposed, so stupid. So it's interesting you use the word stupid. You feel stupid, like you've got something wrong. And the thing about being a kid, of course, is that you don't know much. There's lots of stuff you don't know, and you're trying to know. You know, so kids are, why? You know, that place where kids are, that extraordinary ability to inquire. Because it's really important they know and find ground for themselves. So that acute place of shame really goes very deeply in. And we all are carrying aspects of that. And we have to keep meeting it. I mean, in a way, that's the kind of the spiral part of the glyph, right? Where we keep meeting these. We keep, you know, one of the things, particularly when you get older, you get a bit impatient with yourself. Oh no, not that again. But the thing is, it's not a repetition. It's another turn of the spiral. You keep meeting these parts of yourselves, working with whatever aspect of it is touching you right now. And that's where the process of really trying to trust what happens to us and trying and to stay working with it. In a way, that straight bit is about being centered, aligned with the kind of in the middle of whatever the spiral is currently doing. And in a way, it's interesting, really, that it's been a bit fascinating for me this weekend, realizing that Robert Kirk is talking about the seers in Scotland actually literally using a version of the same glyph. I suppose I must have read that at some point, but I have certainly no memory of it at all. And of course, they're doing that because it's an universal image, an image of the straight and the spiral. You find versions of it all over the world. And because it's really about something that's about very fundamental in human nature, that sense of alignment and connection between the depth and the height, and then the spirals of our lives, where we keep working with things. Now, if the straight and the spiral go out of alignment, then we can get, now if you have the straight line without the spiral, without, you have no nuance, you have that sense of belief, right? I am the sword of God. There's no kind of subtlety. There's no organic movement. It's like, I just know. If, however, you have the spiral without the straight, you have no sense of center, no sense of direction, no sense of will. You have this kind of, everything's sort of lovely and I'm floating in this kind of world and I believe everything and everything's lovely and it's a sort of mush. It's the dynamic tension that exists between the straight and the spiral that actually is almost the engine that moves all this. And as we work with this, one of the things that we have to acquire the some of the ways of understanding of working with this territory. Which, if in a more shamanic-based culture, we would have learned as children, that we would have learned. Well, how do you know the difference between something that is just a repetitive image on the surface and something that's a deeper image? We would have worked with that and learned about that in the same way as we learn other things. And in a way, partly what we have to do when we address ourselves to this work is learn some of those skills, in particular that skill of discernment, of getting a sense of when is something operating from a deep in me and coming up, or when is it just a repetitive defensive image from the surface of my mind. That's a really key thing. And the thing is, you have to learn it in practice. It's all about practice, because it's about the thing about the deep images is they're rooted in the unknown. And they have their own mysterious life, and they're not easy to make sense of, even if they're known images. Now, what happened to me with the Lilith image is this figure comes in, pushes everything else aside, just sits there, solidly there, and won't go away. Now, generally speaking, when I have repetitive images, they're more amenable. I can kind of push them away more easily. They don't have the kind of the quality of independent life that some of the images for the depth are. Though that said, sometimes they do, because I'm caught in some repetitive belief cycle of my own. So the other thing that's pivotal here, and why there's no rule that we can give, and that's why it's an art in a way, is you have to know yourself. You have to know the kind of, there's quite a different experiential flavor to the repetitive parts of myself that are kept, because they've got a kind of, they've got a sort of automatic, slightly mechanical feeling to me, and that's just my way of making sense of that, right? Where the sort of places where So the actual repetitive bit of my experience in that experience of Lilith was actually the place where I'm trying to push it away, because I don't want, you know, I want something new. Mm-hmm. So the, in those moments, when something new is happening, normally there is a defensive reaction from some part of your own soul, right, that is trying to, that is trying to disable the living experience. So, just as you can, if you give me, but you've given us such a good example, that place where you think, I can't say that, right? It's silly. It's just, oh no, there I go again. So that's all part of the repetitive mechanical reaction that's trying to keep you safe from the pain that you experienced when you felt humiliated in the past around that. So, and because one of the things that happens, right, as we get past that, as you come into contact with that living image, what can happen has just happened with Maria. You touch the pain. You touch the pain of the past and the loss of that. So you feel emotional, you feel sad, and you feel a bit out of place as well. And that often is because that's some of the feelings that were there at that time. You feel you've been silly, you feel you've been stupid, you feel you've been inappropriate. And so all of that gets packed away. So as you touch into the living image, the defensive reflex appears that holds some of those energies, some of those feelings. Now, if you can stay with it and get past that sense of embarrassment, what then starts to happen is you start to touch that kind of deeper image, that which then starts to move in some way. And when we use image, just be clear, we're not talking necessarily visual image. It can be a kinesthetic image. It can be an auditory image. Part of that problem as well in our culture is everything so externally visually orientated that what we can forget is when we have these experiences, actually very often we don't, it's not about seeing, it's about feeling and sensing. And sometimes the images get clear later on when you do that. But come back to Jung for a moment. In his very early visions, what he talks about, he has this sensation of dropping down. And then eventually he feels like, but doesn't see, that he's standing on squashy mud. Now he's not seeing squashy mud. He has a visceral sensation of his feet being in squashy mud. So when we're looking at this kind of work, if we're very visually oriented and we get images easily, that's straightforward. But if we're not, what we have to notice our other senses. It's not just second sight, as I say. It's also the subtle senses we have, not so much just the five senses, but the kinesthetic sense, right? The sense of where we are in place, sense of warmth and coldness. The sort of more global senses that orientate us in space are also what come into play here. So I'm describing something as I'm experiencing it using a variety of modes. Now you may see nothing of the images I describe. You might be sitting there feeling enclosed, feeling sense of going down. Sense of other beings, whatever that means, and the sense of connection. Now that is as fully and as powerful an experience as the visual image, but it's not valued in quite the same way because of the externalization of the visual image that happens in our culture, combination of advertising and TV and film mainly. The images, we find the visual image that's out there. So it's the difficult thing of working with our own version of the experience, which will be different from mine, but will speak to you, if we let it, in the way that is right for you. That said, you have to, what is also there as you try to experience it, is defense and obstruction and fear of old pain. So that's also there somewhere, that's also hanging around the experience, and that also has to be worked with somewhere. so as not to stop us. But it all comes back in the end to that sense of being aligned with whatever the sense of presence is, and trusting that image of the glyph. In a way, this glyph in Swipes was the first thing I gave you. This glyph is the doorway to the whole thing. In one way, you could just spend your time just looking at that for 2 years, and you'd get as much as anything we're doing here, probably. But the trouble is, in order to do that, and do that successfully, we'd have to live in a different culture. One, we'd have to live in circumstances where people would leave us alone to let us do that. And we'd have to live in a culture where people would say, yeah, it's a really important thing to go with that. Go meditate on the glyph for a couple of years. And then we'll see where we are. And then we'll have this great job waiting for you then, when you can do that. Because then you'll be ready to do this great job. It'd be a really different world if we could, you know, let that happen, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, if instead of sending people to university to learn things by rote, you go away to a version of Hogwarts where you really kind of work on these things and come out as these really connected people. So sadly, we can't simply do that, so we have to find other ways to help each other in what we're working with, the culture that we're working with.
I don't want to take apart what you've been saying, but I would like to challenge
challenge away.
So I am struggling
challenge
with
is good.
Lot of what you're saying.
Okay, good.
And it might be my own defences, so I put my hand up to that.
Yeah, go on, tell me. Yeah.
But there's something about, I suppose for me, I believe that inside of us are all things.
Yeah.
You know, that we are the most incredible beings, ultimately.
Yeah.
And I also believe that a microcosm of the world externally is also inside of me.
Yeah, surely.
I am that world.
Surely, yeah.
Whenever I've had that kind of, or I've been on a workshop where I get to choose a totem animal, or I get to choose, I immediately feel it's like believing in something other than myself, or other than that world. Almost like I can hand over an aspect of myself to there, and therefore I don't need to take complete responsibility somehow. So there's a little bit of that going on.
Okay.
And then there's a whole kind of, for me, that all of these characters, whatever they might be, whether they be a fairy or whatever, my sense is they're an aspect of my own psyche. So they could be something internal that I might utilise if I need to experience something, or be able to sit with someone in a certain way, or be able to connect with someone, or be in a place. What I struggle with is the moment you externalize that as an object or a separate entity that somehow then I need to build a relationship with in order to get where I already am. So that's what I'm talking about. So can you take that form of where you are and put some reference? I don't know if you're able to do that, but that's what I'm...
No, I think you're talking about something really important here, and it's complex. It's part of this whole issue of what is inside, outside. What's the vision of the world that we're looking at here? Okay. Now, because you're totally right that these things are inside us, but I guess what I'm saying is they're not only just inside us. Now the bit in the Robert Kirk book that's interesting where he talks about everything being nested in something and everything else. So this idea that every being has other beings within it, and we are, and basically he's giving us this image of the world where everything is profoundly connected and contained in everything else. The reason I'm stressing the externality of it this weekend is because that's the part that never does get stressed. In the way our culture expresses it, it expresses it just as you've described, everything is inside us. So when we deal with these things, we're talking about internal energies. And that is true. I'm not saying that's not true. It is true. But what I'm also saying is that these, that this deeper life is also outside us. So when you relate, you are of course relating to things that are experiences inside you. But what I'm saying is they're not just inside you. They have their independent life. They're not just a part of your psyche. They touch you through a part of your psyche. And whatever we call them, whether we call them fairies, angels, gods, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, dum-de-dum-de-dum-de, they're not just part of your own psyche. That's, I guess, what I'm that's the challenge I'm making back somewhere. Yes, they're found inside you, but they're not just found inside you. That's why synchronicity happens. Things, what I'm suggesting is that you were living in an universe of profound interconnection where things talk back, not just from inside, but literally from outside.
See, I would describe that as a mirror of your own psyche.
But that's because you're privileging your own psyche as the main place. I would say it's a mutual mirroring.
Mutual mirroring.
Right? That actually, and in a way that's what, and that's really what Robert Kirk in his 17th century way of trying to describe, he's talking about a mirroring that goes back and forth. Now he's using quite homely metaphors when he talks about somebody who's a great eater having an elf that shares his food. So what he's saying is that there is a mutual sharing, a mirroring that happens.
But doesn't that happen when you meet someone that you love? Wouldn't you say that that could be a mutual mirroring?
Yeah, exactly. And
could
what
that not be the being that you're describing?
Well, the being that you're describing, is the physical being you're in love with, is outside you. All I'm saying is the imaginal figure is also outside you, just like that. We are figures, so simultaneously I am a figure in your imaginal world and you are mine. We've known each other a long time, right? So that's and we're independent of each other.
So I can understand, I can get that.
Yeah.
It's when you start to make it into a form.
But what I'm saying is the imaginal figures are the same, right? You experience them inside yourself and they're outside you.
Okay.
And I don't say to believe that. It's a theory to hold and to get interested in. So in exactly the same way that you and I are figures in each other's world, so I've got an internal Becky, and you've got an internal Ian, and also we are external to each other and independent of each other. Mm. It's the same thing. With all these things, there are internal kind of representations of these things. And what people like Jung and Robert Kirk are suggesting to us, these things are also independent of us. And we do need to build relationship with them, not just simply in us. So that's the challenge back, I think, in some ways.
Sleep on it.
It's not something, yeah. None of these things are things to be believed in, right? The whole point about this is they are things to test out and be with and discover. This is not about belief. This is about experiment and holding a thesis lightly and seeing what happens if we follow that.
Thank you.
But the interesting thing is the relationship we make with them is on the inner.
But what's that mean, you see?
Well, in the imaginal realm.
And what's that mean?
That's the connection. Well, it simply means the place that enables the connection.
That's right.
That's its definition, really.
Sure, but where is that?
Well, it is both inside and outside.
That's right. Yeah. And that's tricky, right? It's easy, so what we mean, and so in a way that's part of what we have to do. We've got to take all this stuff apart a bit. What's it mean?
Mm.
What's it mean that something is inside and outside? I mean, the first thing, that sounds nice. And then if I think about that, that gets a bit freaky.
Mm.
I really start to engage with inside and outside and the idea that that's a continuum of experience rather than two separate places. Mm. It starts to freak me out a bit.
Mm.
It gets a bit real.
We're in the realms of building thought forms and things, aren't we? And stuff like that. Or is that a complete tangent? You know,
I don't know what you mean by that. Tell me, explain by that.
Well, I'm just thinking the Fountain Trust. You know, they want to spread harmony and light, so they protect a piece of crime-ridden streets, and they imagine a great big glass, lovely thing protecting it, and it has an effect on the outer world. It has a measurable effect. Crime goes down, you know, because of people's work on the.
That sounds good.
I'm just thinking if once you do it in what I'll call in your head, you're actually establishing its independence from you. at the same time.
I think the more challenging thing might be for us to think about that there is no independence.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that actually, that actually we're always working on that edge where inside and outside are connect because it's a continuum. Because if it's a continuum, there's no edge. And I think that's hard, you know, and that's something. Anyway, that's the, I feel like the central thing that we keep on inevitably coming back to.
Like walking a knife edge, isn't it? You know, yeah. It's like walking the bridge, yeah.
You're walking the bridge, that's right. Anyway, let's cross the bridge into lunch.